Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating and all that stuff. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about where words live in our brain and some really interesting research reading the neurons of our brain as we listen to words. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. Before I get into news round, I have been obsessed with AI from the very first days of ChatGPT. And when I speak to people, most people don't really understand how to get the most out of this technology, and it can do almost anything. So I decided to put on an event to show people how to get the most out of it. So on September 24th in Dunleary for 2 hours in the morning from 8 to 10, I'm going to tell people how to properly get the most out of ChatGPT and other LLMs. I'll introduce them to other AI tools that I use for email and for note-taking. They're amazing. And I'll also show you how to properly use ChatGPT so that you get great results if you're like looking for fairness in a contract you've been given, or you want to create an FAQ for your business, or you want to train a chatbot. I can do it for you in 45 seconds. It's incredible. Manage HR tasks, compile documentation. There's so much stuff that you can do, as well as become way more productive by using these tools. And that's what I'm hoping to help people to do. The event's called Getting Started with AI. Just put that into Eventbrite and you'll see it. It's on the 24th of September. Hope to see you there. Right, it's time to look back at some of the week's news from the world of science this week. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD join us. Our first story, Shane, has to do with hot temperatures.
Yes. What's the hottest temperature a human can survive in? It's a great question, right? I think many people probably consider this as they go on their holidays in this day and age. I've just avoided going to the continent now in July and August. It's just too warm for me. I think we all kind of have our own sense of what temperature feels good.
What's too hot for you?
Oh, in a kind of a sunny climate, 30.
What?
Yeah,
25 for me.
Yeah, I don't want to go anywhere where I can't walk around. Like, and I don't, as people might imagine, I do not like sitting around at the pool or on the beach. So I would want to be out hiking and doing stuff and anything. Yeah, 25 is probably comfortable. Beyond that, it's just like, it's too much. You have to get up at the crack of dawn to enjoy the day. I'm guessing by your face, you're probably somebody first.
I could do 30, but I do need to be near the coast and need to have access to water. Like, I can't do cities at plus 25. I can't do it. I find it very hard.
Have you ever been to the tropics?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know why it's easier, but like, I think you're just mentally prepared for it. So I've been to, you know, I've been to Africa and I've been to the Ecuador, and something about just the fact that you're there, you kind of know what's going to happen.
But 30 degrees there feels hotter, right? It's this idea of humidity, right? And this is what this story is about. It's this idea of a so-called wet bulb temperature, right? The maximum. So they measure this. It's not just a kind of a crude measure of what the weather app tells you. Today is 30 degrees. You think warm or cold. You think it in an Irish context. If you go to different climates, the humidity will vary. And so will the amount of direct sun. So if you go somewhere, I've been to Beijing once where it was 40 plus and it was really dry. So I didn't feel that hot. Hmm. Whereas I was in Singapore many years ago and it was around 30 degrees the whole time and I found it unbearable. Hmm. There's a humidity. So you can measure something called the wet bulb temperature.
Yeah, what is that?
So basically they get a thermometer and they wrap it in something like a wet cloth, right? And so as it heats up, it will evaporate the water from the cloth and that has a cooling effect. And eventually it maxes out, and so effectively you can't cool it down anymore, and that's worrying for a human because effectively we're kind of like wet bulbs too. So if we get too hot and we're not able to cool down through evaporation, through sweating, then we overheat. So body temperature is 37 degrees. It was thought until this study was done that 35 degrees was about as hot as you could bear in a wet bulb scenario. So somewhere tropical that was 35 degrees, a young, healthy person would only survive on average for 6 hours. They will die really quickly. Yeah.
Wow.
I've seen adventure programs on the television where people are hiking across parts of Africa where they're in direct sunlight and high grass. And people who are healthy enough to go on these long expeditions, the Simon Reeve style programs, people died really quickly just from overheating. So the body cannot handle it. You have no way to cool down. So it was thought, based on a previous study, that the magic number was 35 degrees in high humidity. But physiologists have gotten involved. Not surprisingly, they're in Australia, which has extreme temperatures, and they built something called the Chamber of Heat, which sounds like kind of a mix between mixed martial arts and Harry Potter. it's a 4x5 room, and somehow they've convinced people to spend a lot of time right. in this environment, and they've looked at all their vitals as they live. And crucially, they're living in there, right? So they're wearing clothes, which the previous calculation hadn't assumed. They can sweat, which the previous calculation crazily hadn't assumed, and they move around. So basically, they're normal people doing normal things. They also looked at their age, which was crucial, and they found that the maximum temperature that a human can survive in is a lot lower than we previously thought. And this matters because a huge number of the world's population now work in heat extreme. So it's thought that 70% of all workers in the world are working at times in heat extreme. That's a couple of billion people. So they looked not just at the limits, right, which range for younger people between 26 Celsius and 34, again, wet bulb temperatures, and for older people, between 21 degrees, right, and 34. And they found that as we age, we can't lose heat as efficiently as we can when we're younger. So you can get into a panic situation. They also look critically, I think this is good, because otherwise it'd be a terrible story, at effective ways to cool down.
Mm.
And they found that generic ways of cooling down don't always work. And Mr. Freeze, exactly. That's my way to cool down. Yeah, I know.
Love
Mr. generic
Freeze.
Ways to cool down that are often given in public health advice are not necessarily based on good physiology.
Oh, really?
So if you're using a fan to cool you down, if you're using it in desert-like conditions versus humid conditions, it has a differing effect. In a desert-like condition, it blows hot air at you, and that makes the heat stress worse.
Mm.
If you're in a humid situation, a fan cools you down. So they've looked at all these different scenarios. They're trying to advise the WHO, basically, how should we help people cool down in extreme heat.
Yeah, and some of the stories we've seen over the last number of years of just like crazy temperature. And if you get to some of these scenarios that the humidity is so high and the heat is so high that there's nothing you can do.
It's awful.
Unless you have air con, there's nothing you can do to cool yourself down. And that's incredible, because your core temperature is, when I realized how sensitive our core, we can only tolerate a degree or two in our core temperature before things get really, really bad in the body. It's kind of crazy.
I've said it before, we live in the best climate in the entire world. I completely believe that. We're so blessed here.
And we have hot boxes now looking at plants as well, because we have to think about plants and other animals, how they're coping, and what's their temperature range, survival.
Our second story, Ruth, is an interesting one, because it has to do with citations. So first you're going to need to set the scene for us and why citations are like likes for scientists.
Likes for scientists, yeah. Well, I mean, as we always say in research, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and scientists always refer back and other researchers refer back to previous work when they're publishing papers. And, you know, every week on this slot, you know, we talk about new scientific papers that have come out. But when scientists talk about the work that they're basing their new work on, they reference that work to give credit to those researchers. And that's called a citation. And so you can imagine over time, as we build up a big body of knowledge in research, some papers that are incredibly influential will be cited many, many times. And over the course of many decades, citations have become a really important currency in science and in research, because they're now used by many of the top institutions to inform things like hiring decisions, to inform promotion decisions. You know, there's research funding agencies which will use them to decide on the quality of an applicant. Now, there's been a lot of discussion, helpfully, over the past couple of years that is not always a good metric. And I think nowadays we approach it with a little bit more caution, because the reality is any metric can probably be gamed. But this research, which was discussed in Nature News this week, looks back at a couple of different studies which really confirms what I think many people suspected around the imperfections of citations as a way of measuring the quality of research. So this is work that was done, which was looking at how essentially citations could be manufactured. So fake citations, fake papers. And of course, you mentioned AI at the beginning of the show. That's now a new tool, which really gets in the way of what was kind of quite a pure endeavor before. But also actually about a black market online where you can buy citations. So what the researchers did was they went through a database. There's a database called Google Scholar, which many, many people in research will use because it captures all of the research papers that are published and the citations that are contained within them. And what they did was they examined 1.6 million Google Scholar profiles that had at least 10 publications. And then within those profiles, they looked for people who had at least 200 citations, but where their citations had increased by 10 times or more each year. So that seemed to be a very unusual level of increase in referencing of a paper. And they found over 1,000 profiles that fitted that bill. And then what they did was they went and looked at the citations, and they found that a lot of the references were to unpublished papers or to references embedded in preprints which had not yet been peer reviewed.
So the upshot of this is that these scientists seem like more prolific, more expert, more respected,
more hireable.
But it's essentially like like Airbnb reviews for sale, sort of.
Yeah, exactly. And what they did then was they pressed a little further and they made up a fake Google Scholar profile for a fictional scientist, and they used AI to generate 20 papers that were essentially gobbledygook. But within a few months, they added citations in as well, fake papers that were citing these papers. And this person actually became, in the field, it was fake news was the field that they developed the papers in, became the 36th most cited researcher in Google Scholar. So none of this was picked up when the data was being scraped and analysed.
They're on the show next week, incidentally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But then, actually, when they were going through Google Scholar, they found companies, ads embedded, where companies were advertising citations for sale. So if you didn't have the sort of technical skills to do it. So for $300, they were able to buy 50 citations, which they did. And again, within a few days, within 40 days, there was 50 new citations from studies in 22 different journals, and they were all recognized by Scopus, which is another highly respected database. So it's just sort of a cautionary tale.
I suppose because most researchers who are working at an expert level in a field are very aware, because they meet at conferences and they know the papers and they read the papers, it's not going to really have an effect on what they think or the community thinks, right?
But what's for sure, absolutely, because there's so many scientists and it's so competitive. So I think ultimately this comes down to the fact that there just are not enough jobs for all the scientists out there. And so people do extraordinary things to give themselves the edge.
I know
somebody who told me recently, my own university, they'd applied for 200 jobs to get one. I don't think there's many other fields out there where it's that competitive. So you do crazy things to get in.
Yeah. And again, we now use things like CVs where you describe what you're doing rather than just based on numbers, because the reality is any metric can be gamed, but useful to have the science showing us exactly what's going on.
Our third story has to do with dino rocks.
Yeah, we finally
from
know.
Space.
We finally know what killed those dinosaurs 66 million years ago, which was the end, really, of the big dinosaurs on Earth. A whopping 60% of species were knocked out and made extinct when a whopping big city-sized asteroid hit the Earth. I stumbled there on the word asteroid because you had to be careful. There was a lot of thought given to as to whether it was a comet that actually hit the Earth. And I had to look up what's the difference between a comet, an asteroid, and a meteor. So a comet is ice and dust. An asteroid is rocky. And a meteor comes from a meteoroid, which is a small piece of either comet or asteroid that enters the Earth's atmosphere, a shooting star, effectively. So most asteroids live or are found between Mars and Jupiter. And it was thought that one of them may have struck the Earth. And what they're able to do to kind of figure it out is look at the trace elements that you would find from within these extraterrestrial objects. There's a balance of different chemical elements on the Earth, and we can look at some rather rare ones to kind of get fingerprints of those that came from space. And so Enter here the scientists, and what they did was they went and looked for a particular element called ruthenium, right? Which I'm sure Ruth will be happy to hear about.
Never heard
and,
of it.
No, ruthenium. Me neither. It's one of the rare ones. It's very rare on Earth. And there are 7 stable isotopes of ruthenium. So isotopes are basically different versions of the same element. And they looked at the balance of them, and they were able to tell basically from the balance of ruthenium isotopes where in the solar system it came from. Because when the solar system was formed, the inner solar system is light on ruthenium in certain ways, and the outer solar system is heavy. So there's an uneven distribution.
Oh, right, okay.
Isn't it clever? And they're able to tell then where this asteroid came from. So we now know that it came from just outside the Jupiter ring, and it struck the Earth. It wasn't an extra solar object. It came from within our solar system. It's probably been there since the beginning of the solar system, and yeah, it was gunning for Earth from day one, and yeah, it wiped out a whopping number of species. But fortunately for us, we're here.
I was going to ask, could you not just trace the trajectory into the Earth? And then I realized the Earth moves, and so does the
all these things move.
So
yeah,
does the solar system, and so does the solar system within the universe. Yeah, so it's
best
kind of tricky
that way.
Yeah. So that was a stupid.
No, thought. I can't figure that stuff out either.
Yeah, our final story has to do with toxins from snails, Ruth.
From sea snails, more specifically, and the sea snail that we're talking about is called Conus geographus, or the geography cone snail, and it lives in tropical water in the kind of Indo-Pacific region, and it hunts small fish. So it's a few inches long, maybe 10 centimetres, and it sits on the bottom of the ocean, but it can shoot out a little sort of proboscis, which is filled with very, very poisonous venom. It's one of the most poisonous snails. It can kill a human. So there's, I mean, it doesn't kill very many. There's been about 36 recorded fatalities in 300 years. It's actually also called the cigarette snail, because the sort of gallows humours was that if you get stung by one of these, you have enough time to smoke a cigarette before you die.
Oh, wow.
That's not actually true. You could probably survive about 5 hours, but you will die.
It's a couple of cigarettes.
Yeah, maybe a pack. This is very, very toxic stuff that comes out of the snail. And previously, scientists had identified that one of the chemicals inside the snail was producing, it was very, very like insulin. So it seemed to have something to do with blood sugar. And this is another piece of research sort of building up what's going on. It's a multinational research team led by the University of Utah. And they've discovered an additional chemical. There's a whole cocktail of chemicals in there. But this chemical is, again, very interesting because it mimics another human hormone. And that hormone is called somatostatin. And that also regulates our level of blood sugar. So there's definitely some connection going on here to mimicking chemicals that are involved in hormone and sugar regulation. And we use somatostatin as a drug as well. So it's used for people who have excess growth hormone, so who have gigantism. But it's also used for some cancers. But it's not a great drug in the sense it has to be injected or placed under the skin, to be delivered in an implant. And it has quite a lot of side effects because of the complexity of these hormone pathways. And interestingly, the snail's version, Constatin, seems to be much more specific and much longer lasting. So it has a very particular amino acid in it, which helps it to persist in the body. And of course, they found out now with the snail, what it appears to be doing, it's using its kind of insulin mimic when it attacks its prey, which is usually a fish, not a human. But that brings the blood sugar of the fish right down. And then the Constatin, the version of the other hormone, is essentially keeping that blood sugar down. So it's preventing its prey from bringing blood sugar back up. And it's sort of like a diabetic coma, and it enables the snail then to eat its prey.
Wow.
But it sounds like this could also be very, very useful for us, because this molecule now can be taken. It probably wouldn't be given as is, because obviously
you don't want to die.
You don't want to die.
Yeah,
there's some really interesting elements here, which really drug designers have failed to come up with for decades. But of course, this snail has had millions of years to evolve this biological system. So really interesting.
One final question before we go. It is a full week since Electric Picnic. Is that voice from Loreen or is it from Kylie?
Bit of both.
Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. Thanks very much. Now, whether it's through reading, conversing, or even doing the simplex crossword on a Saturday afternoon, we're constantly adding to our inventory of words and broadening our vocabulary, hoping to better communicate and make sense out of the world around us. But how are those words stored in our brains, and where exactly? just what does our library of language look like? Well, Ziv Williams is associate professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at Harvard Medical School. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Ziv. It's great to have you. This is such a fascinating area of research, and I've been following this as we've been making sort of minor strides towards, you know, essentially reading what's happening inside someone's brain for a long time, actually, nearly 15 years. Let's talk a little bit first about what we know about where words are in the brain. Because we have place cells, right? And place cells are neurons in the brain that are related to individual geographic sites. Do we have the same for words?
Yeah, so that's a really fascinating question. The simple answer to that is we still don't know entirely. We've been able to sample the activities of individual neurons, which are basically the most simplest computational units in the brain that are able to process information. And we wanted to start asking a really basic question of, first, are there individual neurons that process the meanings of words at a very basic level? And so one of the really interesting things that we found is that there are some neurons that are very finely tuned to the meanings of particular words. So for example, certain neurons may respond uniquely to any words that have to do with animals. So for example, if they hear words such as dog, cat, bunny, they will respond very uniquely, but not to any other kind of words. And there are other neurons that will respond uniquely to words that have emotional connotations, such as happy, sad, glad. But how this information is broadly represented across the brain, we still don't know entirely, not at the level of individual neurons.
So what is the processing that goes on in the brain before we start talking about your physical experiments, if you don't mind? So someone says the word dog. What happens in the brain to process what that word means and make meaning out of it?
It goes through sequential process, as best as we understand it. So it starts from basic sound signals that are processed at a very low level in parts of the brain, like the auditory cortex of the temporal lobe. So this is part of the brain close to your ears. And their information is thought to be processed at a very basic level. So the sound features like phonemes such as ka or ba or da. And from there, it's thought that this information is assembled into word level representations where we're able to process the meaning of words more broadly. So we're able to glue those sound signals, connect them into individual words and extract meaning from them.
And does that happen in the auditory cortex still, or is that passed elsewhere? And how do we know what's going on where?
Right. So we don't know for sure, but it's thought to spread to other parts of the brain. So this information percolates very rapidly throughout your brain, including parts of the brain such as the associative temporal cortex. So these are parts of the brain around the primary auditory cortex, and then to frontal areas that are thought to extract meaning and infer higher level conceptual representations from language. So it's thought to very rapidly spread throughout the brain, and different parts of the brain extract presumably different aspects of meaning from these sound signals.
Right. And we're sort of starting to understand this through tools like fMRI, which monitors blood flow through the brain. But it's not easy to tie down, right? So tell us a little bit about your experiment and what you were trying to do. What was the methodology, please?
We use these ultra high resolution microelectrode arrays
needles that stick into neurons, right?
Yeah, so these are very fine electrodes. They're about the size of a human hair, but they're able to pack up to 1,000 little contacts. They're able to listen to the activity of individual neurons. And using them, we're able to pin down the activity of single cells in the brain as participants are listening to these sentences and stories. And what we could do is we could track the activity of each individual neuron and ask, what happens when the participant hears words that refer to animals or emotional states or objects during natural language? And by tracking the activity of each individual cell, we can ask questions Like, does this particular cell seem to get excited whenever it hears a particular word like dog, cat, or bunny? And do other cells respond uniquely to words that have emotional connotations like happy, sad, glad?
How do you identify neurons from what must be millions of neurons in the prefrontal cortex? How do you know which ones you plug into?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And so you can think of these recording devices as little radio antennas. And you have multiple radio antennas that are all listening to the chatter of individual brain cells all simultaneously. And every cell has a unique activity profile that you can actually pluck out of that noise. And you can, at a fairly coarse level, anticipate that particular activity is coming from a particular cell. It's not a precise science, but there are a lot of different techniques that we use to allow us to confidently tell that we're recording from one individual neuron and not another. And we can listen to up to several hundreds of cells simultaneously in certain conditions using these microarrays.
And so when you get someone who has these electrodes in their brain, presumably these are epilepsy patients?
These particular patients were individuals that were undergoing neurosurgical procedures for movement disorders. Central tremor or Parkinson's disease.
Okay, because it's normally the poor epilepsy patients who become the guinea pigs for all neurosurgery. So So in this case, you have a number of patients. They've got these neurons being listened to. And what are you doing? You reading out words and monitoring what's happening? How do you isolate what's actually being said and make sure that when you look at this activity, that's actually what you're picking up as well? Because obviously the brain's processing loads of things at that moment, right?
Right, yeah. That's an excellent question. So we had the participants listening to pre-recorded audio sentences or stories. So stories, for example, about the lives and times of Elvis Presley. And we could align the activity of each individual neuron to each word that was spoken. So you could very precisely tell when the words happened. You can also tell under what context they happen. So what was the sentence being spoken that led up to a particular word? And we can track the activities of each individual neuron very precisely as these words were being heard. So we could ask, every time that a particular type of word was heard, did the activity of that neuron change? And if it did it consistently enough, then we could say with a certain degree of confidence that that particular neuron was tuned to or preferentially responded to a particular word meaning.
Oh, right. And the important thing here is word meaning rather than word, because things like sun, sea, even chair, they have different meanings. And it's the meaning that we're seeing the activity for, not the specific word. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct. And language is a really fascinating and interesting process. So we all do this seamlessly, and we're able, for example, like you said, to tell the difference between two words that sound the same but have different meanings. So C, for example, I see you, or the C was very rough today. And because of this, we can ask very specific questions about, do these neurons really care about the meaning of the word rather than simply their sound form? And the really fascinating thing was that many of these neurons fairly reliably track the meaning of words, even when they sounded the same. And we can use all kinds of other interesting approaches. We can actually also ask, certain words are more similar to each other in meaning than others. So, for example, dog is much more similar in meaning to cat than dog and chair. And we can...
So do you find like a partial overlap because they're both four-legged mammals?
Exactly. That's actually a really interesting point as well. And we can quantify these similarities. We can quantify mathematically how similar one word is to another in meaning. And so we could start asking questions like, do these neurons really... capture these relationships across words, and can we actually map them out And the one of the really interesting findings from the study is that you could actually map out how the brain represented particular words and all the relationships across all words that were heard by the participants, which amounted to about 200,000 word pairs. And we could, based on that, build a fairly detailed picture of how does the brain process all these meanings as are represented within language.
We're often told that AI works very differently to the brain, but what you're talking sounds very much like, you know, what machine learning might look like, that rather than the word being important, the features of the concept put together are important, and that's why we have overlaps of certain neurons firing. An interesting experiment might be to look at the brain of someone who has unusual associations of those words. So someone whose dog was called Trigger, for example, would presumably would have an overlap with dog in that case, even though most people wouldn't. Is it difficult to, because people have individual understandings of words, is it difficult to take anything general from this brain activity from one person to another?
Yeah, that's an absolutely fascinating question, and something that we've wondered about, because like you said, one person may have a different conceptual representation of the word mother or father than somebody else.
Yeah, mother is a great nightclub here in Dublin. That was the first thing I think of. No offense, mom.
The really interesting thing that we found was that it's a lot of these representations or the way we represent certain meanings are fairly generalizable. So we could compare the activities of one participant to another, for example. So we could ask, not necessarily does one person have one type of cell exactly as somebody else, but we can ask questions such as, do people have a similar representation or distribution of neurons that happen to encode information about animals or objects or emotional states? We can also ask questions like, can we actually decode that activity? Can we listen to the activity of the brain cells and predict what somebody is actually hearing? Mm. And we found that these word meaning representations were fairly consistent across participants. Now, keep in mind, we're only sampling from a small portion of neurons within a vast network of brain cells, but we're asking a more simple question. We're asking, do people have similar subsets of cells in their brains that represent these word meanings, as opposed to do people have exactly the same cells in exactly the same parts of the brain?
That's really interesting. And I think, you know, trying to figure out how language forms in the brain is really, really, it's fascinating. Whether or not it will be useful for mind reading, which is, of course, what people worried about their privacy, you know, in a long run, maybe not. But I was going to ask, how many of these cells do you, I know you're only recording a few hundred out of millions, but how many, do we know roughly how many cells are, you know, fire, we call firing, but, you know, show activity when it comes to an individual word? So if I said to you balloon, how many cells in this area would be firing?
Right. That's really interesting question. Something that we're just starting to scratch the surface of. So we found that approximately 15 to 20% of cells responded to any word meaning, meaning that they may have responded to one particular meaning or another. But to very specific meanings, that's even a smaller fraction of that cells, which makes sense. When you think about it, you likely don't want to have every neuron in your brain respond to the word balloon. At some point, you need some unique pattern that represents individual words. Hmm. The other really interesting thing that we found is that there was a broad range of gradations or granularity within which these neurons represented particular meanings. Some of the neurons were a little bit more generalist, meaning that they responded to any words that refer to animals or animal adjacent type representations, such for example, a bird, egg, and nest, all have some reference to animals. But some neurons were much more specific, where they responded much more uniquely to particular types of words and not others. Mm. But those were far more fewer than which made sense to a certain degree.
Are there certain areas of the brain that deal with certain types of words, or are they all mixed together? Like, would you have the neurons that fired for carrot beside the words that fired for serendipity or loquaciousness or pensiveness? You know, these sort of abstract emotional states. Are they in a separate emotional, you know, neuron firing area?
Right. So that's a really interesting question. So there have been some hints to that within the functional imaging, within functional imaging studies that have shown that certain areas are a little bit more sensitive to particular types of meanings. What we found at the single cellular level, but we still don't know for sure, is that many areas represent a broad mixture of meaning. Representation. So we will find within a particular recorded area neurons that respond to animals and emotional states. We find also neurons that represent meanings fairly similarly. We don't know the distribution of those yet. We would have to sample much more broadly to really get a sense of how do different brain areas represent particular meanings.
Yeah, I guess it seems because the brain, you know, the unborn brain doesn't have meanings to associate together, it kind of would be crazy if there was a specific part of our brain that all clumped together. There were things that had to do with stone, you know, and right. Another side. So, I'm getting the sense that, you know, when we think of our brain, we really do need to think of sort of cobwebs of meaning that all link together to give us, you know, bone as an idea, but right. There's so many things that each word isn't a word. It's a meaning in our brain as opposed to a word that encapsulates that idea.
No, exactly. And when you think about it, all words have multiple related meaning representations. So you may think of a dog generically, but you may be thinking or talking about a dog that is red, or a dog that is running fast versus slow, or a dog that happened to be your pet. So these words don't live in isolation. They are embedded within this vast network of all of related meanings. And somehow you're able to glue all these concepts and features together into a cohesive meaning representation. And we're just starting to understand how that may happen.
Your colleagues in Harvard a number of years ago came up with a sort of a controversial test called the implicit association test, in which it showed people images and words and tried to get them to respond very quickly to reveal biases that they may have.
Right.
And so it's slightly controversial as to whether or not it actually gave us anything, because, you know, if we are racist or if we are sexist, it's more of our behavior rather than our thinking that actually is defined by the term racism or sexism, right? But if we were to use this and started to learn where neurons overlapped in people's brains, you know, would we be able to understand, you know, whether or not someone associated, you know, a gender with inferiority, or a race with, you know, intelligence, or so on? I mean, if would we be able to see overlapping of concepts on a neural level if we had all of the neurons being recorded and mapping it meaning in that way?
Yeah. It's really hard to tell. It's really hard to infer what somebody may be thinking from the activities of individual neurons, partly because you're only sampling from a very small part of the broader network that is your brain. So one of the open questions in neuroscience is, how do we take the activities of all these hundreds of millions of neurons and how do we combine them into what we subjectively or implicitly feel or think? What we're able to do, though, is to start dissecting the really fundamental computational building blocks that make this happen. And so one of the things that we're really trying to understand is what are the basic elements and units you can think of these as the basic transistors of a microchip or of a computer. How do they work, and how do they all combine together to create these representations?
Really interesting speaking with you. Ziv Williams is Associate Professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at Harvard Medical School. Ziv, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's it from us on this week's podcast. Thanks to producer Simon Keane, Aidan McKelvey, and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.